finds me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Another juicy episode of Abandoned Manitoba, and that's the word that Gordon Goldsboro used. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning. Yes, juicy it is.
What are we talking about today?
Well, listeners may remember that last week we discussed the scandals surrounding Thomas Kelly, for which he did time in Stony Mountain Penitentiary. Today we're discussing another scandal where the perpetrator ended up in Stony. But unlike Thomas Kelly, who spent only a fraction of his sentence behind bars, John McCrae ended up dying in jail.
So who was John McCrae?
Well, born in Scotland in 1865, he came to Winnipeg as a 9-year-old boy to live with his uncle, Robert McCrae, who was bishop of the Anglican Diocese of Rupertsland. Now, under his uncle's tutelage, John McCrae received an excellent education. For example, he attended the University of Cambridge in the UK before he returned to Winnipeg to article in law with a prestigious local firm. He was called to the bar in 1890, and he became a partner of that firm a few years later. Jump forward to 1904, shortly after his uncle's death, he marries a daughter of wealthy brewer Edward Drury, who had the brewery over there on Main in Redwood. Everything seemed to be going McCrae's way. You know, he had an impeccable family background, he had married well, and he was a respected lawyer.
So when did things start going wrong?
You know, it's difficult to pin down exactly when McCrae's life began to change, but perhaps we can say it started in 1906. That was the year he was elected to the Council of the University of Manitoba. The following year, 1907, his law firm was contracted to manage all of the university's investments, and it had lots of them. You know, to maintain the university, they had, for example, land grants that they could sell to raise money for the operation of the university. In 1916, McCrae was appointed university bursar to manage the institution's finances, and through the 1920s and early 1930s, he chaired the university's board of governors.
So it sounds like he was pretty intimately connected to the university.
Oh, he was, and the university was not the only Winnipeg institution in which he played a significant role. He was an Anglican, and in 1907, he had been appointed chancellor of the diocese. He chaired the finance committee of St. John's College, which was the Anglican post-secondary institution here in Winnipeg. And in the 1920s, he became its bursar. So, you know, he had his pulse on the financial affairs of a lot of things.
So is that where the scandal comes in, related to financial mismanagement?
Indeed it did. McCrae invested the funds in his care that belonged to the university and the Anglican Church in things like real estate and building projects. You know, so for example, he bought a large swath of land in the western part of Winnipeg that later became Silver Heights. His investments had initially gained in value, and of course that's what you want, but in 1913, Winnipeg's real estate market collapsed, and with it, a lot of McCrae's investment portfolio. He was on the verge of bankruptcy. Well, to keep himself afloat, he took out mortgages on the land, or in many cases, he withdrew money from the investment accounts that were under his management. By 1918, he had depleted the trust account he was managing by $500,000. And yes, that sounds like a lot of money, but that's the equivalent of $11 million in today's money.
So didn't anyone notice?
Well, you'd think, right? McCrae's law partners did notice, but he tried to reassure them by separating the law and investment components of the firm's practice. And for a while, it worked.
What about people outside the firm?
Well, McCrae was a prominent member of Winnipeg's elite, so a lot of people trusted him implicitly. A major family connection, he had married well, he was a lawyer, you know, they trusted him. He used his position as the board chair and bursar at the university to conceal the growing deficit, and he purposely put off financial audits by claiming that the bookkeeper who maintained the accounts, a fellow named Robert Shanks, was grievously ill. He was just too sick to help, so, you know, we'll just have to wait until he's feeling better. When the audits did occur, well, he transferred money between accounts to make it seem that everything was in order. he was able to hide his mismanagement into the late 1920s by speculating in things like wheat and oil futures. But the onset of the Great Depression in late 1929 finally sunk him. An audit was carried out in 1931, and it turned up a shortfall of $672,000, but he was able to put it off for almost a year, and again, because people implicitly trusted him. But finally, in August of 1932, he could no longer conceal the losses.
What was the total extent of McRae's embezzlement?
Well, Premier John Bracken wanted to get to the bottom of things, so he appointed a royal commission to investigate the matter. And after it looked into it, it laid primary responsibility for the embezzlement on McRae and his accountant, Robert Shanks. The total losses to the university were estimated at $1.92 million. And again, to put it in perspective, that's the equivalent of about $42 million today. McRae had essentially lost the entire sum of the university's investments to that point. Everything was gone. The losses to the Anglican Church and St. John's College, well, that represented another $1.5 million, and that's the equivalent of $34 million today. So we're talking about vast sums. And, well, there's also an unknown quantity lost because he was also managing the investments of small investors who, again, had trusted McRae because of his connections. So I don't know that the total loss from all of the sources will ever be fully known, but it was undoubtedly an absolutely staggering sum. Many of the losses were due to bad real estate investments. In other words, McRae hadn't technically stolen the money, but it was actually shown at trial that he had, in fact, taken $300,000, about $7 million today, for his own personal use. So there was an element of personal culpability there, too.
What happened to McRae?
Well, he was charged with theft, he was tried, he was found guilty, and he was sentenced to the maximum possible penalty, which at that time was 7 years, and he was duly sent off to Stony Mountain Penitentiary. Meanwhile, Robert Shanks, who had helped McRae to conceal the missing money and who had been chronically ill for years, he escaped justice by dying a few months earlier. One of McRae's law partners, Frederick Sharp, was found guilty of negligence. I guess the idea was that he knew about it, but just did nothing to intervene. Surprisingly, he was not disbarred. You know, he was a practicing lawyer. They didn't disbar him. And in fact, he continued to practice law for many more years, but not with McRae's old law firm because, well, not surprisingly, it declared bankruptcy. The provincial government's comptroller general, Robert Drummond, he resigned over allegations that his scrutiny of McRae's affairs had been inadequate, and I think that makes sense. To make up for its lost funds, well, the University of Manitoba had to raise tuition fees, and of course, students always complain when tuition fees go up. Well, how would they complain if they raised by 80%? Because that's what happened. They raised the tuition by 80% while also cutting staff salaries by 13%. Well, in fact, the heads rolled at the highest level. So the president, the chancellor, the board of governors of the university were all replaced. McRae himself, well, ultimately he only served 9 months of his sentence because in October of 1933, he died of stomach cancer behind bars.
Isn't there a building at the U of M called McRae?
Yes, there is. But I want to hasten to point out that McRae Hall was not named for John McRae, lest anyone think that we're commemorating an embezzler. No, that building was named for his uncle, Robert McRae, who was, in fact, the university's first chancellor. And I have to think that Reverend McRae would have been horrified by his nephew's crimes if he had lived long enough to hear about them. But in fact, he died 28 years before the McRae embezzlements came to light.
Did they ever get back the money that McRae had stolen?
Well, of the $1.9 million that had been lost by the University of Manitoba, only about 2% was ever recovered. And that was from McRae's life insurance policy. I guess they just garnished it and took it all back, so the family got nothing. In 1933, shortly before he died, McRae's home on Harrow Street was put up for sale. And I assume that was to help in paying back the various investments who he had defrauded. Interesting enough, that house was later occupied by Douglas Campbell, who later became the Premier of Manitoba. You know, in fact, I was informed just the other day by a listener that the former McRae residence has recently been put up for sale. So I have to think, there's a house where if the walls could talk, wow, I have to think they'd have a lot to say.
Juicy indeed. Thanks for this, Gordon.
You're welcome.
What will we be talking about next week?
Well, a year and a half ago, we talked about an apartment block on Roslyn Road here in Winnipeg that had been constructed using an innovative technique called lift slab. Now, that block was demolished a little over a year ago, and another lift slab building on Portage Avenue, now standing empty, may be gone soon, too. We're going to talk about that building and others like it next week.
I look forward to that. Thanks, Gordon.
Talk to you then. Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons.